How can you achieve and maintain business growth? Harvard Business School Executive Education is now accepting applications for a new program, Driving Profitable Growth. Taking place in Boston from October 25th through the 28th, this program focuses on business expansion and organizational growth strategies that can lead your company into the future. Learn more about this three-day program for senior leaders by visiting hbs.me/growth. That's hbs.me/growth.
You are Locked On Lakers, your daily podcast on the Los Angeles Lakers. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team, every day.
Welcome, everybody, to the Locked On Lakers podcast. I'm Anthony Irwin. I am joined by Harrison Fagan. In a little bit, we're going to be joined by Roland Lazenby to talk about his book, Showboat, The Life of Kobe Bryant. That was a really, really good interview, a fun interview. A bunch of information there that I don't think many people knew about Kobe, so that's fun. Also, the Lakers won last night. They played the Kings, and they beat them. I believe it was 101-91. So that's something to, so we're going to recap that game and then talk about some of the stuff to look forward to as the season rolls along. Harrison, you didn't say anything here, so say something.
I'm excited to go to our post-game recap and our interview with Roland Lazenby.
Absolutely. So find our show on Audio Boom, iTunes, Silver Screen and Roll, TuneIn, Stitcher, and today's Fast Break. Make sure you're using the promo code LOLakers on SeatGeek to get your $20 rebate. Let's get to the show. And we're live. Welcome, everybody, to the Locked On Lakers podcast. I am Anthony Irwin. The Lakers won. They are the dark days of how long had it been since we had last seen a Lakers win? 2 days?
Yeah, it's been a long drought. They lost 2 days ago. Fun fact. Yeah. But they won last Sunday. So
it does feel like forever ago.
Hey, it's been almost half a week. So yeah. Yeah, that's a long time to go for the way Lakers have been.
Yeah, so here we are. The Lakers are back in there. They have regained their winning ways. They sit now at 5-4 and avoid falling below 500. Although it looked like they would, it did not look good early. Right, they fell down, I believe, as much by as much 19 as 19. In the first half. Yeah, 19. But I. This was one of those games that even while they were down by that much, and even though the Lakers have come back in other ones, that I really felt like, yeah, they just might not have it tonight.
Yeah, I mean, I think you tweeted at me that can we just record the show now, like in the middle of the second half? That would have been a very different show if we had recorded it at the end of the first half and just like pretended like we watched the third and fourth quarter and we're like, yeah, and then the Lakers got blown out and...
The first place I wanted to start with this show was that lack of quit. The Lakers, even though tonight it looked like they just didn't have it, they found their way back into the game. It was like you blinked and what the hell? The Lakers are within five? How did that happen? I legitimately don't have an answer for how it happened. So Harrison, how did it happen?
Well, I mean, Mozgov was really good. Lou Williams and Nick Young kind of caught fire. I think in the third quarter, honestly, it was Russell that kind of brought them back, which is kind of why I thought it was weird that he didn't. I guess not that weird that he didn't get a shot in the fourth, considering how well Young and Williams were playing. But it was kind of that guard rotation and the play of Mozgov that really brought them home. And Randall was pretty good too.
Right. The defense also stood out, right? Where in the first half, they gave up 55 points. The second half, they gave up 36.
Yeah. So Larry Nance Jr. had a couple good sequences to that effect. Really, this was a team win in the second half. There really isn't a guy that you can point to and be like, yeah, he just should not have been out there tonight.
Right. Well, I don't know. Do you want to talk about Deng?
Okay. Never mind. yeah. So there was one guy that maybe shouldn't have been out there. Deng was very much not good tonight.
I asked this question the other day. The other day when I wasn't on the show, you had spoken about Deng. And then the selling point or the headline for the show was, at what point do we start worrying about Deng's contract, or should we start getting worried about Deng's contract? And I said, yes. And, a couple of people said, well, it's still really early. I'm still pretty nervous about it. And my question, I guess, is, and even though we weren't really planning on talking about this, but which game would you start? Like, would it be the 15th game? Would it be... is there anything along the way that you would hope to see?
If I'm being honest, it's like 20 games in, I'd say, just because it's the first year of a contract. He came into the year a little bit hurt. Maybe they shut him down for a little bit. And when he comes back, this is all kind of a thing of the past where he looks a little healthier and has a little bit more pep in his step. But yeah, I mean, it is a little bit worrisome. But again, I have to remind our viewers that you're one of the ones who thought that Julius Randle not playing in summer league would be catastrophic for his career. And we know how that turned out. So like you're the guy that just kind of, you react to things as they happen, and I'll bring the even keel. So I think, I don't know that it's time to panic about Deng's contract, but it is time to worry a little bit, I guess.
So this has been the segment where Harrison pats himself on the back for being Spock. I hope everybody enjoyed that. That was brought to you by your local calculator dealership, where whatever that might be. If they
Anyone who knows me and has listened to the show knows that I'm not good at math. So,
all right.
Actually, I guess that's why I need the calculator.
So, all right. We spoke about Deng. We got a little off track there. I wanted to talk about the lack of quit, and we keep on coming back to it's easy to just keep saying how these guys are having fun. They will do whatever it takes to not let their coach down, whatever it might be. But I feel like that's selling those guys short a little bit. The guys who are actually out there putting forth the energy to get back into a 19-point game probably deserve a little bit more props than just saying, oh yeah, well they just like their coach now, right?
It's not mutually exclusive. Maybe they're playing a little harder because they like their coach, but they're also continuing to play hard and they deserve credit for that. And they're playing well and they deserve credit for that. And sure, Luke's putting them in better positions to play well, but mm-hmm. they deserve credit for not giving up down 19. This is a game where they 100% would have given up last year. I there's no doubt in my mind that they would have just let this one kind of play out the string.
This is, I don't know how many games now. The counter to this is maybe at some point stop getting down by these, double digit leads. But,
I haven't done the research, but I think generally winning teams don't do that.
it seems like an annoying habit to pick up. Like, gosh darn it, guys, like we're back here again. But it does say, it is nice to see that at every step along the way this season, I've thought to myself, yeah, this wouldn't have gone very well last season or the year before that, or even really the year before that, to be completely honest. This team has more fight than I think Lakers teams have in recent years, because even the title contending Laker teams were good enough where they said like, oh, you know what, we didn't have it. Let's just make sure we get the next one. Whereas I think these guys really have, it's a set priority that like, no, there is no such thing as a game that we can just get away with.
If I remember correctly, that second title team with Kobe and Powell definitely enjoyed giving up an early lead and coming back just for fun. So maybe this team has been watching. So Luke Walton had some experience with that. Maybe he discovered like, hey, that's a recipe for success that I'm going to subscribe to. You go down by double digits in the first half and then your team, then you're playing with house money. Then mm-hmm. you can just go out and either you win the game or, hey, you get credit for trying.
The other thing, so I wanted to talk about the defense, and the thing that I really enjoyed from the first half to the second was how in the first half, I thought, you know, even it's the excuse is Boogie makes a couple threes and now you got to adjust to, all right, we have to get out there and get a hand up and stuff, right? And then they would get a hand up and they would close out hard and he would get a dribble by them. Now, Boogie made a couple of those late in this game, but I thought in the second half, they did a really good job of staying a little bit more controlled in that closeout with Boogie and with Ty Lawson, that those guys weren't getting into the lane to wreak havoc the way they were in the first half. And again, the results are there. 36 points in the second half is a great defensive second half. We didn't see that much at all over the last couple of years.
Yeah, and as Luke Walton said after the game, he summed it up better than I think we can. Our guys have proven that when they play hard and they're engaged in what they're doing, they're capable of beating anyone on any night. And mm-hmm. I think that that's the best you could have hoped for from this season, if you were being realistic, is that the Lakers, maybe they wouldn't win every game. Actually, they definitely wouldn't win every game if you were being realistic, but they'd have a chance. And they've put themselves in a lot of chances, and so far they're coming out ahead more often than not.
This just in from Ben Golliver, at Ben Golliver. He apparently got a quote from Boogie on the little dust up with Julius Randle there at the end.
I'm excited to hear this.
It's not too bad. He says, just some friendly UK love. Julius is like my little brother. So, DeMarcus, future Laker, 2018, that's going to be fun.
I think he just said that. He said I think that maybe that's what he was whispering to Julius Randle at the end of the game when they went chest to chest. And that's why Randle was smiling and why all the Lakers were just kind of looking over with their eyes wide. They weren't worried about a fight. They're like, did this dude just say he's joining our team next summer?
That's why Tarik Black had that look of like, oh man, like they're going to
wait.
Minutes.
He signed Mozgov and then that means, oh, darn it.
Yeah, that's
the math in my head. That was my mistake.
He used one of your calculators.
Tarik Black, though, can't blame him for being in a good mood and like playing fairly well tonight. This year, I would imagine he probably got a locker in the Kings locker room. Last year, I think the Lakers put him in the closet. they threw his stuff on a chair in a closet or something. Mm-hmm. This was back when he was being known as kind of milk carton. And, the dislike from their last coach for his style of game was kind of at its peak. It actually might have been in Sacramento when he got accused of not playing balls out enough. I don't remember. But I really hope that
Tarik takes tonight as an opportunity to say, like, you know what, we played balls out. We played balls out tonight.
That legendary status if he drops that after the game.
That'd be phenomenal. All right, let's move on to the next topic that we were going to bring up, and that's D'Angelo Russell. You talked about him earlier, about the way how, you know, he was a large part of the Lakers getting back into the game. Which is good, but I think the larger topic moving forward is how this is yet another game where Lou Williams closes it out. Is it a similar stance? Are you going to take a similar stance like you did with Deng, where it's like, oh, you know, we'll just see. We'll give Luke a little bit more time to figure out these rotations, or should we be a little bit more forceful with our analysis of, yeah, it'd be nice to get D'Angelo Russell in these games late, especially close.
I don't know. I don't want to dodge the question, but I don't know that the answer is either of those things. I think the games where Luke has left Lou Williams in to close, Lou has been like a complete fire-breathing dragon, and he was playing mm-hmm. pretty well tonight. And so I think that group was playing really well. So I think You can almost excuse, yes, Russell is the future. He's the team's young point guard, you hope, that's going to lead them forward into this next era. That's certainly not going to be Lou Williams or Nick Young. But down the stretch tonight, those two guys were playing really well. And I think with the type of culture that Luke is trying to build, I think you almost have to roll with that. This isn't like the last couple years where it was just rolling with a veteran for a veteran's sake. Luke is benching the veterans when they aren't just, you know, like they aren't unstoppable. But tonight mm-hmm. they were playing really well. And so, Brandon Ingram was hardly having the best game, and Luke played him down the stretch. So it's not like he has this predisposition against youth. It's just he's seems to be rolling with the five who are playing the best. Like, he even closed with Mozgov tonight, which he hasn't done really much.
Oh, I thought that was purely because DeMarcus Cousins is a really large human being. But
that too, that too.
But I, the one thing I will say about Lou, and we kind of brought this up in yesterday's show, was Lou Williams is still going to be, like, if the Lakers hope to be in playoff contention next year, right? I think that's the goal, is that next year these kids take a step forward, and the expectation is to contend for the playoffs next year. This year is kind of whatever win total they wind up with, great, as long as they develop. And as last I looked, Lou Williams' contract is such that he's probably going to be on the Lakers next year. And the hope is that he continues to play a meaningful role on this Lakers team. And by letting him play some of these late game moments and developing, you know, aptitude for creating off the dribble, handling late game situations with the ball in his hand, next year when they're good, that's just one more option that they can go to. And it runs counterintuitively, because you usually think the future is D'Angelo Russell, and he obviously is the future. But I do think Lou Williams, while he's in Los Angeles, is a part of that future. And I don't really have that big an issue with them trying to groom him to be the best player that he can be in the role that they're hoping he can fill.
And again, it's early in the year, so maybe later in the year, then D'Angelo starts to get some of those minutes, even if Lou's playing well, if they're out of playoff contention.
Yes, and again, like, this is the Lakers have played 9 games. We aren't even an eighth of the way through this season. I would imagine over the next tomorrow or the whenever. Yeah, no, they don't play tomorrow. They play Saturday, right?
Yeah.
On Saturday, it wouldn't surprise me at all to see Russell close out Saturday's game.
Yeah, and Luke said that his sitting at the end stemmed, it was just basically, this is via Mark Medina, he paraphrased, but basically Young and Williams were playing well. Their size and Russell's turnovers were the reasons that he sat down the stretch.
And Russell, to that point, had 5 turnovers, and 1 assist. That's the opposite ratio that you want to have from your point guard. And now look, I'm going to avoid a fine here. I'm reminding myself to avoid a fine. For those who are going to yell at us and say, hey, you're analyzing this team differently because you happen to like Luke than you did last year when you didn't like that last coach, my response to that is that last coach, not only was he not grooming the future, but he was losing in the process. Luke has won 5 games in, I think, a fifth of the time than it took.
The Lakers didn't win 5 games until towards the end of December last year.
Right. So, you know,
he's earned more leeway.
Right.
He's earned more leeway with the way that he's coached the team, as far as putting them in better positions to be successful, and with the way that he's communicated with the team, with how much buy-in he clearly has, all of that stuff. He's earned himself more leeway.
Right. And you don't want to, you know, results-based analysis is kind of lazy. So just to point to the wins, it's, you know, check out the wins, you know, isn't what we're doing right now. We're just saying, you know, it is a minor issue right now, and it's something that we're going to pay attention to as the year goes along. But for right now, I'm not freaking out because Russell doesn't seem that upset about it. The team doesn't seem that upset about it. They're winning games, and they have some momentum early on in this early season. And pointing out something that I think can be fixed really, really quickly, that's not a problem, you know?
Yeah.
Next guy that we wanted to talk about was Julius Randle, who we just spoke about, had no
we reference this a little Bernie. Bit, but we can you could probably count the amount of players that Julius Randle is afraid of on one hand, because it doesn't exist. So you don't even have to raise a finger.
If Boogie looked at me like that, like, how would you respond to that? Boogie comes over, gets right up in your grill. How do you respond?
if DeMarcus Cousins walked over to me, knocked my laptop, like picked up my laptop, threw it on the ground, and then looked at me like that, I'd apologize to him for being in his way.
That sounds about right. I would apologize to him, his family, like his teammates, you know, but Randall showed no back down whatsoever.
Randall laughed. The whole thing. He laughed. He laughed at him.
You make a great face. Like anytime I start taking a conversation in a place that you aren't very comfortable with, your eyes get like this big. You know, I could just see that look on your face, like, oh my God. But Randall sat there and laughed about it twice, because Boogie had already been upset with him early in the game and gave him a shove, and he laughed about it. And then now after the game ended, he laughed about it. The game before this, or no, two games ago, Tyson Chandler, who also is a large human being, was not thrilled with Julius Randle. He didn't back down then. He laughed about it then. Is Julius Randle a sociopath?
No, I think somehow Julius Randle decided that when everybody was comparing him to Draymond Green, it meant he had to troll the crap out of every single NBA player. Yeah. So I think he's just went that route. And, you know, hey, you can't argue with the production he's getting out of it.
They're showing it now. And yeah, Boogie wanted nothing to do with it. They've just played a really, you know, grueling and tough basketball game. You're running up and down the court all the time. Unless there was some Tic Tacs involved, I can't imagine breaths smelled all that great. That
I can't confirm from post game locker room scrums that is the case. Not anyone in particular, but just that happens sometimes.
If somebody was that close to my face and didn't have great breath, I don't know if I would be smiling through that. Although they do say that, you know, a good way to avoid throwing up is to smile. So maybe that's what Randall had going there. He was smiling to avoid throwing up.
Yeah. I mean, or maybe again, he was smiling because DeMarcus Cousins said, "Hey, I'm going to join the Lakers when my contract is up. I like the way you play, kid. Good job."
Hey, you made me smile. About his actual game, though, so a play happened tonight, and I don't mean to throw a wet blanket on this party, but a play happened tonight that I've been talking about all season, where they've been very keen on putting Randall in situations where he's allowed to gather himself and make a decision after taking inventory of everything that's going on in front of him. Tonight was one of those plays happened where a pick and roll happened on the other side of the court. He was at the top of the key. One more pass would have led to a wide open Nick Young three-pointer, I believe. Instead, he, you know, gathered the ball and wound up attacking the rim. And I think he shot a floater that went off of the front of the rim, wasn't really close. And that's why I'm saying, Luke, in that kind of situation, I would imagine the play got thrown off and Luke would kind of kick himself and say, nope, that's not what Randall's good at. And that kind of shows me that, you know, as much credit as Randall deserves for the way he's played this season, I think part of it, a lot of it has to do with Luke putting him in situations that he's the most capable and the most comfortable.
I agree. I think they have a lot. Both those things can be true, right? He can have improved as a player, and he can also be being put in easier situations to show that improvement.
And I would hope that both things are true, because that makes that situation all the more sustainable.
That is less fun, though. You want to embrace debate right now? Just argue over which one it is. Since you think Randall's terrible, I'll let you argue for Luke, and I'll argue for it. No, we don't have to do that.
No, that nobody wants to watch that. Otherwise, people just wake up early and watch First Take. But with Randall, the thing that I keep on, he had a play today where he wrestles the ball out. It's a loose ball underneath the rim. He wrestles the ball out, takes the ball coast to coast basically, and while keeping his head up, finds Lou in the corner for a three-pointer. That Lou three-pointer takes it to, or pushes it to, a 10-point game. That play basically sealed the game for the Lakers. The Kings, I don't think, came within, you know, 4 points of the Lakers from that point on, if not more than that. And again, all props to him for improving on his play. He finishes tonight with 15 points, 8 rebounds, 5 assists, 4 of 10 shooting, which isn't great, but 7 of 7 from the free throw line. He's shooting above 80% from the free throw line this year. There isn't much that you can really nitpick, and that's all I was doing earlier, was I was kind of picking nits. Randall continues to be hugely impressive.
Yep, I have no disagreement there. He's been, I think, like we've referenced a couple times, better than either of us even thought he could be in our even in our wildest projections.
And this all coming after the fact that he risked his career by not playing in Las Vegas Summer League.
Risked his entire career. His livelihood as an NBA player was at stake because Larry Nance Jr. played in Summer League and he didn't.
I think I even said that he might get traded.
I think you insinuated that Larry was going to start over him because he showed more commitment to the team. So maybe remember this next time we're out in Vegas and you're overreacting to Summer League.
Throwback Terrible Take Thursdays.
Yeah, we'll bring that up again on next Tuesday's show.
All right. Do you have anything else to add on Randall before we move on to Mozgov?
I do not.
Mozgov was the player of the game today. He gets punched in the face yet again, and the Lakers win. That's my analysis.
I mean, Mozgov, again, maybe at some point, I'm going to say, like, Lakers trainers might want to get him, like, a helmet, get him some bubble wrap just to wear, like, a ski mask, just, like, poke some eye holes and, like, a mouth hole in it. And I probably shouldn't have just done that gesture on YouTube Live, but... but
somebody get that gift.
So yeah, so that he can breathe and stuff, but because that's obviously important. But and then that way you can protect his face a little bit. But yeah, the Lakers are still undefeated when Mozgov gets hit in the face, or they're undefeated in the games after Mozgov gets hit in the face. So because he got hit in the face against Dallas, and you know, it happened tonight. So they're going to win on Saturday. We can call that now. Because Mozgov, the team always comes back strong in defense of him.
I'm really wondering, like, at what point do the Lakers say, hey, you know, we just went through the concussion protocol with Larry Nance Jr. Maybe we should check Mozgov out. He's taken, by my count, 5 blows to the head this year.
Maybe they've been doing the concussion protocol, like all the questions in Russian, but none of them speak Russian, and he just tells them that he's getting the right answers.
It's basically like, all right, Timo, where are you right now in Russian? He's like, Ket.
Yeah, and they're like, okay, I think that's Sacramento. That works.
But regarding his actual play tonight, I thought his size bothered DeMarcus Cousins. And that's why he played late in the game. Very few players in the NBA are able to go chest to chest with Boogie. And even, you know, Boogie rolled through him at one point tonight as if he wasn't even there. But for the most part, Mozgov stood up to DeMarcus Cousins throughout the game defensively. And that's the kind of thing. And he did that while scoring, you know, 10 points is whatever, 3 rebounds is whatever. But the defense that he provided was huge.
I actually thought his, in some ways, especially during like the second half, his offense was actually bigger for the Lakers because, like you said, you know, nobody was really going to stop Boogie. He did do a better job on him than Larry Nance Jr. did. And that's not to criticize Larry Nance Jr. He just doesn't have the size to guard DeMarcus Cousins. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, Cousins, obviously, he got his against Mozgov, but Mozgov made him work a little bit harder for it. And I thought on offense, his screening was unbelievable. He was just like, the Lakers were just dropping pillars for their guards to go around. And, you know, he had the giant lob dunk that everybody freaked out over. And he did all of the things you'd want him to do on offense. He was even making quick passes when he got the ball out of pick and rolls and the rim was cut off. And so he's playing about as well offensively as really you could hope from him.
All right. Everybody watching right now, look at TJF Sports, at, you know, Tom's last tweet with Ingram's part in that little Julius Randle DeMarcus Cousins scrum. That's phenomenal. Go check that out. We'll I think the easiest way is just to retweet it from Locked On Lakers. That's what we should be doing, right?
Yeah, okay. This is great radio for the people listening to this on the podcast. But yeah, I know which one you're talking about. When DeMarcus Cousins came over to the Lakers to chat with Randall a little bit earlier tonight, the reactions from some of the members of the Lakers were hilarious. Tarik Black was just smiling at him. He was ready to go. John Black was like staring. Lakers head of PR John Black was staring. Even gave Boogie a little bit of a stare down. Not real. I mean, he was looking at him, but yeah, everybody was ready to jump in behind Julius Randle.
This Lakers team is fun, and that's the last point that I wanted to make on this show. In over the last couple of years, anytime the Lakers were going to play, a national TV game, it was. Anybody who had any kind of Twitter platform automatically said, "Oh, here we go. Lakers are on national TV again."
Oh, man, the Lakers are on national TV again tonight. Yeah.
And then by the end of the game, everybody would be tweeting about how game that actually wound up being. And then the next time the Lakers, whatever. I'm not bitter at all. Tonight was yet another example. And as the season goes along, I think those complaints are going to start to go away. Yeah. This team is fun.
The Lakers are they're a chic team right now. They are what people were saying the Timberwolves were going to be coming into the year.
Right. And hey, the Lakers happen to play the Timberwolves on Sunday, so that's yet another, really fun game coming up. But I want to say again, I've said this a couple times now on the show, on prior shows, but enjoy this, Laker fans. Enjoy this. One, it's really rare that the Lakers are a popular team amongst bloggers. Like that's never going to happen. And yeah. Two, this is one of those situations where, look, you get to watch this come up. Like you get to remember that one random, Thursday night when the Lakers came back from 19 and Julius Randle got into DeMarcus Cousins' face and the rest of the Lakers were right there to. They made funny faces, but they were there and ready in case DeMarcus did anything stupid. And look, this is why you root for sports, so that you can say, yeah, I've been a fan since back in the day. Whereas other people in, 3-4 years, if the Lakers are contending for a title, they're going to say, oh yeah, I swear to God, I've been a fan. You can kind of look at them and say, nah, I don't think you were.
Yes, the only reason we watch sports is so that we can feel like we're better fans than other people. That's the most fun thing about sports, I think.
It's up there. Like, I know you're being facetious, but it's up there to be kind of drub or whatever.
I embrace all of Laker fans, okay?
I do not.
I don't know. Anthony is out here. He's saying some Laker fans are better than others. Pretty
some Laker fans are Warriors fans right now.
I embrace all Lakers fans.
No, I am here for all Laker fans. I really appreciate it, especially people watching and listening right now. We really, really appreciate it. And just
okay, they're better fans. The ones listening to this, they're better fans. I'll go ahead and say that.
All of you who are watching right now, you are better fans than your friends are. And then if you tell your friends about the show, then you're even better fans.
You're the best fans, and you could tell them that.
Absolutely. We should get we'll make a t-shirt. The best fans listen to Lock On Lakers. All right. That does it for this show, unless you had anything else to add, Harrison.
No, well, I think all we have to add is our interview coming up.
Absolutely. Great point. We are about to talk to, or we already spoke to him earlier today. We're going to add it to the second half of this podcast, which will be up within the hour or so, I would imagine. Really soon, we spoke to Roland Lazenby about his book, Showboat, The Life of Kobe Bryant. Really cool stories in there. Roland was really good. He was really gracious with us. We had some fun. Kobe has something in common with his dad when it comes to world-renowned teammates. So that's kind of fun. Look forward to that.
That was a really solid pun. I got to give you that one.
All right, everybody, we're really proud to welcome in a really special guest honestly, I can't believe we keep getting people on the show, but here we are. We are pleased to welcome Roland Lazenby, who just wrote Showboat, The Life of Kobe Bryant. According to Roland, everything's gone really well. Roland, thank you very much for joining us, and congratulations on the success so far.
Thank you. I'm delighted.
Absolutely.
Okay, so Roland, I guess the first question that naturally comes to mind is, I mean, obviously the book's been well received, it's getting good reviews, but why is that? Why should fans want that book? Because I've been in Kobe scrums, and there are like 50 reporters covering, you know, his walk from the practice, from the locker room to the arena. So, like, what's new in here? Why should fans want this book?
You know, Little Brown is my publisher, and when my Jordan book came out, they wanted to call it Michael Jordan. And there were 27 other books already named Michael Jordan at the time. And that book has gone through, it's in 13 languages. It's in dozens and dozens of editions, reprints upon reprints. The Japanese edition just came out and quickly sold out and went to a reprint. And the only time something like that happens in publishing is when you have done the research to create a mountain of new information and a new way, even a new narrative in terms of looking at very well-known figures who've been covered by journalists all over the world. Now, it's not that I'm better than journalists all over the world, but I have a different process. I have a different responsibility. I'm a biographer. I'm not trying to report the news every day. And David Halberstam, the great writer, told me once that all those news reporters are out there working for you. If you look at it that way as a biographer, and you know, there's no one more appreciative of all the many people covering the NBA. It is a grind. And I've done my share of it. But my book on Kobe Bryant is much like the book on Jordan. The Jordan book totally changed the view of how we see him because I tell the full family story. I offer all the context. Years after the event, people talk about things when they wouldn't talk about them while they're happening. And so Showboat is a book that changes an awful lot of the narrative on Kobe Bryant.
So obviously, I think the book's title is a little interesting, and it kind of alludes to that narrative that he was a little bit of a showboat. He has a reputation as a ball hog. And I did want to ask you about why the title Showboat?
Right. That's a question I've been asked a lot. First of all, Kobe comes from a great showboat tradition. Joe Bryant, Jelly Bean Bryant, was one of the all-time great playground players in Philadelphia history. And that's not a small thing. Philadelphia is an unbelievable basketball culture and has been for a long time. But Jelly Bean was this ultimate showman. And, of course, he was drafted and ended up playing for the 76ers. And he was a guy who could have done well in the age of pace and space. He was a great ball handler at 6'9" and a half. We're talking about Kobe's father. He had a real deep shot. He loved to shoot from the corner, the deep shot. And, of course, the coaches hated that. And with the 76ers, he was part of the bomb squad. Daryl Dawkins and World Be Free. Those three guys came in as rookies together. And they had the Sixers had this serious team. And then they put in these crazy rookies, and the bomb squad would bomb away. And Joe Bryant would have the fans howling in the arena, and they were mad when the coaches wouldn't let him play sometimes. but that great showboat tradition, Kobe was a little kid traveling on the team buses. By the time his old man washed out of the NBA at age 27 and went to Italy, Kobe was this little kid who went everywhere. You know, he'd travel on the team buses, and by the time he was 10, I went to Italy to do the interviews, and one of Joe's former teammates said that one day a 10-year-old Kobe was riding on the bus with him, and he looked at this guy, and he looked at his father, Jelly Bean, and said, I'm going to be better than both of you guys. And so part of my journey is tracing, because Kobe's been accused of a lot of things from the very start. And it's not my job to defend him. He's perfectly capable, if he so chooses, to defend himself. I just want to get the story right, because a lot of people have it wrong, not because they made errors, but because the story that was available gave the impression that Kobe was this guy who was really spoiled and he shoved his way into the Lakers, that he used his will to become a Los Angeles Laker. And none of that was the case at all. Kobe's family wanted a New York agent. They didn't want Arne Tellem. But for this book, Sonny Vaccaro, who was for years the shoe guy with Nike, by then had been fired by Nike and was with Adidas. And he and Peter Moore, who was the Air Jordan designer for Nike, they set a goal of finding the next Jordan. And so Sonny's plan was to invade youth basketball to find the next Jordan. And Kobe wasn't even on the list, but they ran into Kobe at an early camp. Kobe wasn't even invited to Vaccaro's elite camp. He and his father showed up, and his father begged his way in. And they let Kobe in right after sophomore year. Sonny Vaccaro was so impressed. He began telling his secret associates that Kobe Bryant was the next it guy, the next guy with the it factor. And lo and behold, young Kobe begins hearing all of this stir about him. You know, he's a 15, 16, 17-year-old kid, and the guys who did Air Jordan want to make him the next Jordan. And so he was already locked in on Jordan, as everybody in the generation was, but it wasn't his big megalomania that created the Jordan connection for Kobe. That was all Adidas.
It's kind of funny. One thing I couldn't help but make a note of is how, you know, Jelly Bean Bryant played with World Be Free, and it seems like it's now destiny that Kobe would play alongside Meta World Peace. It's funny how that kind of worked out. But
right. Meta World Peace, by the way, in his break from the Lakers, went to play in the Italian League, and the very first game he played was in Tuscany at Pistoia, where Joe had played, and Kobe was an incredible youth league player there. And Meta World Peace, when he walked in the arena and saw how crazy the fans were, he called Kobe and said, "Now I see why you are the way you are."
That's pretty funny. To get back to the Kobe Jordan stuff, because you know, it was almost eerie how much, you know, Kobe held himself and tried to portray some, you know, type of Jordan out there in his early years. And then as the years kind of went along, he found himself. What do you think, in your research for the book, was there ever a moment that he kind of decided, you know what, I'm done trying to be Jordan, I'm going to now try to be Kobe?
Well, I think that I was there spending a lot of time with the team, you know, in his first couple of Lakers seasons. It very quickly wore him down, and people would ask a question about Jordan, and he would get, you know, sort of disrespectful, or he was unhappy with the question.
Mm-hmm.
But Kobe, as for years, was like in 2008, I sat down with Jordan for about 30 minutes, talked just about exclusively about Kobe. And when I told him that during the playoffs, this was, I was at the, in Orlando at the pre-draft camp sitting talking to Michael. And Kobe was in the playoffs, and I left and went to the playoffs and told Kobe, I said, "I've been talking to Michael about you." You know, by 2008, he was wrapping up an MVP season. But he was like a little kid. His ears popped up. He went, "Really?" His eyes got wide. And, and you know, those two guys had a great affinity for each other. It was obvious. in talking to Michael, you know, Michael's not overflowing with the milk of human kindness when it comes to competitors. Uh-huh. And it was obvious just in all of his mannerisms, the things he said. It wasn't, you know, sometimes people will make statements for public relations, but it was very obvious. Jordan has tremendous regard for Kobe and vice versa. But, you know, to the thing, obviously they share a great will, but I like to point out that Jordan's freshman year, he told me when I sat down with him that time that looking at his own career, he said, timing is everything. And he's the guy that had the perfect timing on all phases. And his freshman year at Carolina, he hits the shot that gives Dean Smith and Tar Heel Nation their first NCAA championship. Now, Carolina had won it before, but this is Dean Smith's first. And he was the darling of everyone, and he was instantly the prime guy. And Kobe Bryant at the end of his freshman year was, of course, playing with the Lakers and shooting those air balls against Utah. And Sonny Vaccaro, you know, was sort of his guy. Sonny lived in Pacific Palisades where Kobe did. And, you know, Kobe was the big prize for Adidas. And so right after that game, Sonny called him. He said Kobe had just shot three or four of the wildest shots he'd ever seen. And he asked Kobe, said, "Are you all right?" And Kobe said, "What? Why wouldn't I be?" And Kobe said, "Screw him. Nobody else wanted the shot." And Sonny laughed and laughed recalling that. I spent hours with Sonny Vaccaro in explaining the early years, particularly these formative years of Kobe. And Sonny Vaccaro said, you know, there was not another 18-year-old in the world who could have failed the Lakers in that public setting and have had the will to recover and have the career that Kobe had.
It's while Jordan, especially at the end of his career, right, and you would know this having written the Jordan book, at the end of his career, it was that everybody was going out of their way. Anytime there was an athletic shooting guard, it was, hey, he's the next Jordan. He could be the next Jordan. He could be the next Jordan. And
That wasn't the end of the career. That was going on. Ron Harper at one point was the next Jordan. That's how long that had been going on.
And so I guess, you know, for Jordan to finally have affinity for Kobe, I guess that really says something because he had been hearing about it for so long. And then finally Kobe comes along and Jordan could finally say, like, all right, yeah, I can kind of see it with this guy. Was there anybody else during that process that Jordan said, I could kind of see it with that player, that he might be the next me or some version of me?
Well, you know, Kobe was a young player daring to take on Jordan, and he immediately got Jordan fired up, as you know, at the All-Star game in 2008. He got Jordan fired up in their early meetings. And as Rudy Garcia-Duenas, the longtime equipment manager for the Lakers, said, yeah, Kobe was a young guy at 17, 18, and the league was much older then. And Kobe was really that first bonus baby teenager in the NBA. But when Kobe came to the Lakers, he put all of this pressure on the veterans. They wouldn't talk about it, but he was so athletic, so gifted, so driven, so absent of any sort of conscience, wanting to dunk on everything. It was why Shaq named him Showboat. And they, all the veterans around Kobe, you could just see the tremendous pressure they felt from this whack crazy kid who was going to do anything. And Jordan and Pippen saw that immediately. I was at those games. I'd been writing about the Bulls. You know, I wasn't thinking at all. I did a little paperback called Yo Baby, It's Attitude, where I went around looking at all the guys and doing profiles of all the guys who might be the next Jordan. You know, Iverson, all those guys in that generation. There was a night I saw Ray Allen, you know, in the hallway waiting to get his first glimpse of Jordan as a rookie. They were playing a preseason game. And I was there interviewing him and his fascination with Michael. It was the whole generation. It wasn't Kobe. But Kobe was the one. Kobe was the one that really intrigued Michael almost from the very start.
So, Roland, in the process of kind of putting this book together, you know, what was, I guess I'd be curious about, what was the most surprising thing that you learned? You spoke a little bit about that. It's not necessarily, this book is not necessarily the same narrative that we've gotten about Kobe's career, kind of throughout the 20 years he was in the league. But yeah, so like, what was the most surprising thing that you learned from talking to people?
Well, there's a whole lot of stuff, really. I mean, it's just, and I did a book on Kobe. I spent a lot of time with him. I did a book when he was 19 called Mad Game, the NBA education of Kobe Bryant. And so I was familiar with him, but I really didn't understand the story then. And one of the first things I did in going back, I discovered that although his father, Joe, had been an NBA player and had played 8 years in Italy, the family was desperate for money as Kobe headed through his high school career. They needed income. And first, Joe was trying to set it up so he could force his way to become the coach at LaSalle. And he was going to set up like a Fab Five team at LaSalle. And he was an assistant coach there already. But LaSalle wouldn't make him the head coach. Kobe wanted to go to Duke. He really loved Coach K. But the family needed this money. And Adidas, Kobe was basically Sonny Vaccaro's instrument of revenge against Nike and against the NCAA. Now, Sonny says this. It's a big part of the book. He was looking to take the top player away from the NCAA. He was looking to take the next Jordan away from Nike. And his brilliant strategy was to invade youth basketball, i.e. AAU ball, to do that, to find a kid who was willing to turn pro out of high school. At first, they thought about Felipe Lopez, but no kid, Lopez, none of them, wanted anything to do with the grown man's game of the NBA. Now, Kevin Garnett turned right before Kobe did, the year before, but he had no major shoe deal. But to get Kobe to turn pro, Sonny Vaccaro gave him, in the spring of his senior year in high school, a contract with Adidas worth millions. And then he had a side deal for Joe Bryant that paid him $300,000. And so Kobe signed the deal in late March with Adidas. And as soon as he signed, he turned to Mr. Vaccaro. He turned to Sonny Vaccaro and he said, "Mr. Vaccaro, is there any way that my parents could have this money and I could still go and play college basketball?" Now, Kobe has a lot of bravado and he's sort of a fabulous. He sort of creates the story as he goes along. But in Sonny's mind, there's no doubt that everything being equal, Kobe probably would have gone on to play some at Duke. And Tex Winter, my great friend for many years, I introduced Tex and Kobe years ago before Tex came to the Lakers. And Tex is of the opinion that Kobe had this ambition to be the game's greatest player. And the terrible irony was that to help his family, he had to bypass college, which when Tex coached Michael longer than anyone, he was Kobe's mentor, and he said the main difference between Michael and Kobe is that Michael played 3 years in that very tight, team-oriented system at North Carolina. And Kobe, on the other hand, came directly from being this fierce AAU and high school player. He was so demanding about staying in the game, his AAU coach told me he couldn't have but 9 players. And that was a team with Rip Hamilton. They were managing the personality. The only way they could get Kobe to listen to him and come off the floor was they would get Joe, his father, to speak Italian to him. And so you took this headstrong, very talented kid, no benefit of anything, and put him right in with his, you know, these hard-faced veteran Lakers. It was bound to be an epic collision. Not to mention the fact that just by his personality, Kobe was monumentally aloof, and he has been that way his entire tenure, through youth ball, in his life with the Lakers for all 20 seasons.
That's actually really interesting, the note on youth basketball and how Tex Winter thinks that Kobe would have been a better player if he had played in college. Do you think that maybe that sense of, or at least on Kobe, do you think there's a sense on Kobe's part that maybe youth basketball wasn't the best preparation for going pro, and maybe that's some of why he's kind of railed against it in recent years at press conferences and after games? He's kind of been known to talk about that he thinks that there's a lot wrong with AAU. Do you think that some of that is informed by his own personal experience then?
Well, Kobe treated AAU ball like practice. It used to drive Sam Rhines, his AAU coach, insane. They're trying to win a game, and this is an elite team. All these guys are, you know, AAU is different from high school. This is a team of players who are trying to get Division I scholarships, and they're there to be seen. And Kobe's out there working on his crossover move and might have 6 turnovers in a row to where his coach is screaming at him, enough with the crossover. Can we go ahead and win the game, please?
Yeah, that, the bit about him not wanting to come out of games reminded me of poor Mike D'Antoni when Kobe was playing 48 minutes a game right before he got hurt. Unless Harrison, did you have another question to go with? Because I was going to take it a different direction.
I got one more, but I'll save it for the end. You go ahead.
All right. So Roland, I've kind of noticed, and here's, I guess, a little bit of background on where I'm coming from on this. Kobe is, you know, his career kind of took place while I was growing up, alongside the Lakers, basically, and he is probably going to remain my favorite Laker of all time for as long as I can, for the foreseeable future. And yet nowadays, with the Lakers, you know, kind of going in this different direction, I find myself getting frustrated, for lack of a better term, when I see Kobe stuff come along, because I guess I'm just ready to move on. And I'm not sure, is there anything that can be said about Kobe's tenure, about, you know, how polarizing he was as a player, and it kind of felt like if you were a Kobe fan, you kind of had to defend him a bunch. And I don't know if it's a fatigue thing going on there, but is there anything that, you know, you can draw from Kobe and his tenure that would make fans feel the way I might?
I just always go to the relationship between Kobe Bryant and Tex Winter. Kobe was this aloof guy, but he and Tex were very close. And Tex, you know, was sort of like Woody Hayes. He was Phil Jackson's bad cop. And he would get so angry when people would play poorly. Poor Luke Longley with the Bulls. Tex would literally try to rip his head off some nights. And Tex had a Woody Hayes moment while coaching in college. Tex loved the triangle. Kobe was the ultimate triangle player. Kobe had all of this love and respect for Tex, but there were just some nights that Tex was just not going to be calmed down. And he would, and Kobe was good because Tex would get in his face. And Kobe had much more respect. You know, it's funny, Kobe had great respect for Tex. Michael didn't appreciate Tex critiquing his chest passes. He did. He loved Tex too, but Michael was very close with Phil. Kobe had very little respect for Phil and immense respect. And so there was all this tension on the Lakers staff between Tex and Phil over how Kobe was treated, and Tex would vent to me often about that. But, you know, Tex compared the two men a lot. And he said, yes, Michael had the 3 years benefit of college, but these were different players. They had all the alpha male mentality that made them great competitors. They had this ability on any given night to take over an entire game and do it while ignoring team principles and just go on the attack. And sometimes that would work, and sometimes it would not. And Tex Winter said every night was like high wire act for both Kobe and Michael. Were they going to be able to pull their individual will in line enough to play the team game? And I just think it is the story of two men who played in the same offense for the same coaches who had some great differences and some great similarities, but this talent and this will made it a constant battle for them. And there was always a big public relations agenda going on around the personal battle these men fought each night as they played. And I don't see them as villains. I don't see them as saints. I just see them as immensely talented guys who own the age they played in.
Makes sense. Makes sense.
All right. So, Roland, before we let you go here, my last question was, I was wondering, and you've probably gotten this one a fair amount, but I was wondering, what's your favorite story from the interview process that didn't make it into the book?
Gosh, the book's 560 pages. Kobe threw his family out of his life. All these people that had manipulating him. It's like Sonny Vaccaro said, Kobe was like the Russians with the Romanovs. He got rid of everybody. On the eve of the playoffs of 2001, his parents are living in the house right beside his house in Pacific Palisades. They wake up, there's a soul sign in their front yard. They're gone, their phones are gone, their credit cards are canceled, your cars are towed, sisters too. He throws them out of his life. They've been in conflict, and he ditches them. Then he ditches the agent who made him a Laker, Arn Tellem. Then he ditches Adidas, the shoe company. And so then he gets rid of Phil and Shaq. And then he creates all of this huge damage with Colorado. And Kobe has to rebuild his life. It's really a story of the guy having the will to rebuild his life.
We appreciate all the time. We know we went a little over on time, and this was a lot of fun. It was really fun listening to you talk about this book. And everybody should really go check out Showboat.
Thank you, guys, so much.
Have a great one, Roland.
All right, thank you.
See ya.
Make sure you're following the show on Audioboom, iTunes, Silver Screen and Roll, TuneIn, and today's Fast Break. Oh, and Stitcher. Oh, man, that sucks. I just messed that up. Ah, that's too bad. Make sure you're using the promo code LOLAKERS on SeatGeek to get your $20 rebate. We will talk to everybody again on Sunday. I'm not positive we'll be live after Sunday's game, but you're going to want to listen to that show. We have a really fun guest lined up for that evening as well.
Are we going to call our shot or no?
Nah, not yet. I feel like that jinxes it. I don't want to jinx it.
So. All right. It's Kobe. So
it's Mitch. I'm just going to impersonate Mitch the whole show.
Yeah, that's why we're not going live, so that Anthony can do it and you guys won't know the difference.
No idea.
So that does it for this episode of the Locked On Lakers podcast. Thanks for tuning in. And shouts to Vlade Divac.
Hi, you've reached the High Fashion Hotline.
Hi, my family's going to a tailgate and I want our style to stand out from the crowd.
Just go to Old Navy.
Old Navy?
Yep, Old Navy's got all the latest fall styles. Plus, during Old Navy's colossal sale, you'll save up to 50% off store-wide.
Did you say up to 50% off?
I did, so don't sit on the sidelines. Old Navy has the perfect pants from $19, stylish dresses from $15, and comfy tees for the family from just $6 right now at Old Navy and OldNavy.com.
We're cheering for Old Navy.
High Fashion, Old Navy. Valid 10-2 to 10-10. Select styles only.